Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1, a transitional year resident that will ultimately be going into radiology. This is the 116th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In this episode, I'll be starting a comprehensive review for the USMLE Step 1 for cardiology. I know I already started one for GI, but again, I've been getting lots of requests from people to sort of have a variation in subjects. So I'll just push out many things at the same time, but again, I'll ultimately complete each series. So let's jump right into it. So what if you get a question about a patient? The patient presents with chest pain on step one, and then they show you an EKG and you're seeing ST elevations in 2, 3, and AVF, in leads 2, leads 3, and AVF. What's the artery that has been infarcted? I really hope you're thinking about the right coronary artery, right? Although, remember that the most commonly infarcted artery, right, in the setting of an MI is the left anterior descending artery, right? Remember the LED, the EKG leads that sort of map to that are like leads V1 to V3. So I guess with that, let's sort of talk about the coronary arteries, right? So you know that there are two main coronary arteries, right? There's the right coronary artery, there's the left coronary artery. Now, the thing is, the left coronary artery sort of gives off the left anterior descending artery, right? That sort of supplies like the anterior part of the left ventricle. And then another branch of the left coronary artery is the left, is the left circumflex artery that supplies kind of like the side, so the lateral wall of the left ventricle, and also the back, so the posterior wall of the left ventricle, okay? And then remember that your RCA, your right coronary artery, right, supplies most of your right ventricle, right? And it also supplies like the inferior wall of both the right and the left ventricles. Okay, it does that for the most part through the posterior descending artery. And then it's also very high yield to know that your SA node and your AV nodes, right, the blood, so you're like your SA nodal artery, your AV nodal artery, those classically come from the RCA, right? So if a person has like an RCA infarct, it can actually present as heart block, okay? So that's just one of those things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? And then with this posterior descending artery, right, that I said comes from the RCA, it doesn't always come from the RCA in people, right, but for the most part it comes from the RCA. Like 85% of people have their PDA coming from the RCA, right? That's something called a right dominant circulation. If you have your PDA coming from the left circumflex, right, that's something called a left dominant circulation, right, because the left circumflex is a derivative of the left coronary artery, right? That kind of happens again in like 8% of people. But there are some people where they have like their PDA, like the posterior descending artery, coming from the left circumflex and the right coronary artery, right? That's something called a codominant circulation. I mean, I always wondered, like, man, how can two arteries give rise to one blood vessel? The thing is, the PDA has multiple branches. So if some of the branches come from the LCX and some of the branches come from the RCA, that's what's known as a codominant circulation. That tends to occur more in like 7% of people. Now, the thing you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind is that, so I've sort of talked about the distributions of these arteries, right? How the RCA supplies mostly like the right ventricle and supplies like the right atrium, right? And it also kind of supplies like the interventricular septum, but like the posterior one third of it, right? And then like again the SA node and the AV node. And then I talked about how the left circumflex supplies the side of the left ventricle, so the lateral wall, and also like the posterior left ventricle, right? And then I already talked about how the LED supplies like the anterior left ventricle. It supplies the interventricular septum, right? So the LED has like septal branches, right? In fact, if you have like an ST elevations in like V1, V2, right, that tends to be more of like a septal MI, but that's probably a little too much detail. But the money part of all of this is the papillary muscles, right? So the thing is, the heart actually has 5 papillary muscles, right? And remember, right there, the valve between the right atrium and right ventricle is the tricuspid valve. The valve between the left atrium and the left ventricle is the bicuspid valve, or the mitral valve, right? The easy way to remember that is that you try before you buy, right? So tricuspid on the right, bicuspid on the left. The thing is, of those 5 papillary muscles, we have 3 going with the tricuspid valve, so like the anterior papillary muscle, the posterior papillary muscle, the septal papillary muscle, But on the left, we have two papillary muscles. We have the anterior lateral papillary muscle, and then we have the posterior medial papillary muscle. Those are both with a bicuspid valve. The thing is, the PDA, right, the posterior descending artery, supplies the posterior medial papillary muscle. But the LAD and the left circumflex both supply the anterior lateral papillary muscle. So the thing is, if a person actually has an infarction, like a myocardial infarction, the most likely papillary muscle to basically die or infarct, right, and the person will have like flash mitral regurgitation with that, is the posterior medial papillary muscle, because it only has one blood supply, only has supply from the PDA. Contrast this with the anterior lateral papillary muscle that has supply from the LAD and the LCX. It's actually very high yield to know these pieces of trivia. I know you're like, Divine, this sounds super low yield. I promise you it's not, right? It's one of those things that they love to test on exams. So I guess the next thing we can talk about is how exactly does blood flow in the heart, right? So again, I'm kind of setting the stage here for the pathologies we're going to be talking about later. But how exactly does blood flow in the heart, right? So blood, right? Well, I mean, let's say from the rest of your body, you have deoxygenated blood. That deoxygenated blood, right, flows. In fact, let me just make this even easier for you. Basically, arteries by definition take blood away from the heart. Veins by definition return blood to the heart, okay? If you remember that, you'll be golden for pretty much everything, right? So you take all this deoxygenated blood, right, and you have like your SVC, IVC, bring it back to the right atrium. Your IVC usually brings blood from like the lower extremities, your visceral organs and all that stuff. Your SVC tends to bring blood from like the head and neck, right, from the face and stuff like that. So if, for example, you have like a lung cancer that compresses the SVC, right, a person can have something called SVC syndrome, right? An SVC syndrome will cause like the facial engorgement and all that stuff, right? Usually arises with lung cancer and things of that nature. So you have the SVC, IVC, they bring the oxygenated blood back to the heart, right? And then that blood flows from the right atrium through the tricuspid valve to the right ventricle. Remember, the tricuspid valve is the most commonly involved valve in endocarditis and an IV drug user, right? Because again, remember, if you're an IV drug user, they don't say IA drug user, IV drug user. If you're an IV drug user, you're injecting blood into a vein and the vein drains to the right side of the heart, right? So the tricuspid valve is most commonly involved in endocarditis in IV drug users, right? And then from the tricuspid valve, you have blood flow to from the right atrium to the right ventricle. And then from the right ventricle, blood flows through the pulmonary arteries, right? Remember, arteries take blood away from the heart. So blood flows from the pulmonary arteries to the lungs. Now, also looking at that right side, right? So what if they give you an exam question about a patient that has like episodes of bronchospasm and they have like flushing and they have like all this diarrhea, and then they tell you that you are hearing like murmurs in the at the left upper sternal border and at the left lower sternal border, right? Hopefully you're thinking about carcinoid syndrome, right? Remember, carcinoid syndrome, you have a tumor that's producing serotonin. I remember carcinoid syndrome is high yield from many perspectives, right? But the reason that it's kind of like relevant to the to our cardiac discussion here is that a carcinoid, right, usually doesn't cause any symptoms, right? Because the liver has the ability to metabolize the serotonin. But if it goes to the, if you have mets to the liver, right, then the liver can no longer metabolize it. So those people tend to have like, so that serotonin can make its way from the liver to the right side of the heart, right? The left side of the heart usually doesn't see carcinoid symptoms because the lungs have the ability to metabolize serotonin, right? Remember, the lungs have a lot of metabolic activity. I mean, even angiotensin converting enzyme is found in the lungs. So carcinoids, heart disease, whenever carcinoid causes valvular problems, it causes right-sided valvular problems for that reason, right? And classically, it causes like tricuspid regurg, which you can call tricuspid regurg and pulmonic stenosis, right? But a much easier way to remember that is just remember the term TIPS. So TIPS, right? Tricuspid insufficiency. Remember, another name for regurgitation is insufficiency. So tricuspid regurg, so tricuspid insufficiency and pulmonic stenosis. And then that blood, when it gets to the lung from the pulmonary arteries, it gets it gets oxygenated in the lungs, and then it flows back to the heart through pulmonary veins, right? Flows back to the left atrium. And then from the left atrium, the blood flows through the bicuspid valve. Remember the bicuspid valve has two cusps. It's also called the mitral valve, right? Or the left atrioventricular valve, if you may, right? So flows through the bicuspid valve to the left ventricle, and then from the left ventricle, it flows out to the aorta, right? And remember, the aorta has multiple kind of sites to it, right? So the aorta has like the ascending aorta, we have the aortic arch, we have the descending aorta, and I hope you sort of kind of remember the branches, right, of your aorta, right? So on your the first branch that comes off is the brachiocephalic artery, right? The brachiocephalic artery gives rise to the right common carotid and the right subclavian, right? And then after that, you have the left common carotid come off, and then after the left common carotid comes off, you have the left subclavian come off, right? And again, all these things, I mean, if you remember my vascular anatomy podcast, that's one of those podcasts that you'll be doing yourself a great disservice if you don't listen to before you take literally any USMLE exam, especially like step one and step two, and also your surgery shelf, and also your neuro shelf to a limited extent, right? So there are some key things you kind of want to know about the arch, right? So I just talked about how the right common carotid, so the common carotid artery, right, comes off of two different things. So on the for the right common carotid artery, right, it comes off the brachiocephalic artery, which comes off the aortic arch, versus the left common carotid artery that directly comes off of the arch, right? But the thing is, your common carotid arteries, when they are traveling in the neck, they actually travel in something called the carotid sheath, right? They travel with like two other things, right? So you have the common carotid artery for starters, right? And then you have the IJV, the internal jugular vein, and then you have the vagus nerve. Now, the thing is, the internal jugular vein, so if you're sort of looking at your carotid sheath as a circle, the carotid sheath is just kind of, because remember, right, there's a lot of like real estate in the neck all packed in there. I mean, I really respect the head and neck surgeons. The job, I tell you, is not easy. But basically, right, there's a lot of real estate in the neck. So you try to cover things up as much as possible so that you don't have one thing running into the other, right? So in that carotid sheath, the thing that is medial is actually the common carotid artery. The thing that's lateral is the internal jugular vein. And then the thing that is posterior to all of this mess is the vagus nerve, right? Cranial nerve 10. Now, you may say, Divine, why do I need to know this crap? Well, let me explain why you need to know it, right? One is clinically, and one is also for your exam, right? So if a person is inserting a central line, right? If you're inserting a central line, and let's assume you're doing it blind, probably not the best idea in the world, but again, there are certain situations where inserting a central line should be done blind, like in a trauma situation or emergent situation. But if you're doing a central line blind, let's assume you're doing it blind, right? The thing is, you usually try to palpate the carotid pulse first, right? Because remember, arteries contain a lot of smooth muscles, so they're like pulsatile vessels, and they also contain a lot of elastic fibers, which I'll talk about in a bit, right? So they're pulsatile. So you feel the carotid pulse, and then the next thing you do is literally you feel lateral to the carotid pulse, right? And that's basically where you insert your needle, right? That's where you throw in the central line, right? And usually, I mean, this is more of a clinical pearl, but if people do central lines, you've probably noticed, if you've done any kind of ICU rotation or you've shadowed in an ICU, you notice that central lines are usually placed on the right, right? And the reason that is done is the common carotid arteries, the internal jugular veins and whatnot on the right, they sort of run on their own with the vagus nerve and that's it. But on the left, the thoracic duct is in very close proximity to the common carotid and the internal jugular, right? So you probably don't want to transect the thoracic duct, right? I mean, you can get like a chylothorax, can get a lot of problems doing that. So that's why usually it's a lot smarter to attempt inserting a central line on the right compared to the left. Now, another high yield thing to sort of remember with the aortic arch, right, is remember that the aortic arch, the left recurrent laryngeal nerve, remember that's one of the branches of the vagus, the left recurrent laryngeal nerve loops around the aortic arch on the left, right? Remember, the recurrent laryngeal nerve does not exactly follow the same course on the right or the left, right? Obviously, there are two vagus nerves. There's your right vagus nerve, there's your left vagus nerve. So your right vagus nerve gives rise to your right recurrent laryngeal nerve. your recurrent laryngeal nerve on the right actually loops around the right subclavian artery. Right? Remember, the right subclavian artery is one of the branches of the right brachiocephalic trunk. And then your left recurrent laryngeal nerve actually loops around the aortic arch, okay? And the thing is, the left recurrent laryngeal nerve, it actually has a pretty close approximation to the left atrium, right? So the thing is, if a person actually has like dilation of the left atrium from like mitral stenosis, for example, right? Those people actually can have like, hoarseness. And the reason they have the hoarseness is because they've compressed the recurrent laryngeal nerve on that side, right? So just sort of, again, keep that at the back of your mind. They've essentially compressed the left recurrent laryngeal nerve. They can also have dysphagia because, again, remember that the esophagus, remember the left atrium is actually the most posterior portion of the heart, right? So the esophagus is like smack dab against the left atrium. So if you have left atrial enlargement, that can compress the esophagus and the patient can have dysphagia. Again, kind of like another high yield thing there is, right? So you may ask yourself, okay, Divine, where do people, or if you have you ever, what's this whole concept with a TEE, a transesophageal echocardiogram? A TEE basically involves you putting an ultrasound probe down the esophagus. It gives you the best view of the heart, especially like the left atrium, right? Because again, the esophagus is in very close proximity to the left atrium. That is the primary difference between a TTE, a transthoracic, right? So transthoracic, you're putting the ultrasound probe in front of the heart, like literally on the person's like chest, versus a transesophageal, where you're putting the probe in the esophagus, right? So that's why a TEE is more sensitive than a TTE, right? Because again, the TEE is much closer to the heart because it's again in the esophagus, which is again smack dab against the left atrium, right? And then don't forget, right, like in the heart, we have like the SA node. Remember, the SA node has this property of automaticity, is the primary pacemaker of the heart. You find it for the most part in the right atrium, right? It kind of like, basically at the junction of like the SVC and the right atrium, that's where you find the SA node. The SA node sort of fires off signals. Those signals, and again, I'll talk more about this when we get to the myocardial action potentials, but I mean the pacemaker potentials, if I want to be a little more exact. But basically, you fire off signals from the SA node to the AV node, right? And then the AV node, basically it's kind of like a slowdown mechanism, right? Because the thing is, if you depolarize the atria, right, the thing you want to happen first is you want, after the atria depolarized, they squish, they send blood to the ventricles. You kind of want enough time for the blood to get to those ventricles before the ventricles then get depolarized, right? So the AV node sort of helps as a slowdown mechanism with that, to keep signals from immediately traversing, bam, and going straight to the ventricles. And the thing is, before signals even get to the AV node, usually the two atria are depolarized first from the SA node, and then those signals again travel to the AV node, and then they traverse the AV node, go down something called the bundle of His, right? The bundle of His is actually like a kind of a myocardial cell, but the thing is, it doesn't have as much in the way of sarcomeres, right? So like it doesn't present as much resistance to the flow of electric current, right? So that thing, so SA node, then AV node, bundle of His, and then from the bundle of His, you then have like the right bundle branch and the left bundle branch, and then from the left and right bundle branches, you have things known as the Purkinje fibers that ultimately send signals to the rest of the ventricles, right? So again, kind of like a few high yield things to know there, right? So you see me talk about like the left and right bundle branches, right? So if you have problems with like the left bundle branch or the right bundle branch, that's where the bundle branch blocks come from. Again, I'll talk about those when I talk about arrhythmias. And then if a person has like an issue, right, at the level of like the issue at like at the level of like the bundle of His, or they have issues like with the Purkinje fibers, those things can cause very serious heart blocks, right? More like the Mobitz 2 heart blocks. Remember, there is such a thing as a first degree heart block, there's such a thing as a second degree heart block, there's such a thing as a third degree heart block, okay? But the thing is, the second degree heart block has two types, right? There's Mobitz 1 and Mobitz 2. Basically, Mobitz 2 heart blocks are lower, are things that are arise when you have issues at the level of the bundle of His and the Purkinje fibers. Remember, the Purkinje fibers are a conduit for electrical conductivity between the bundle branches and the ventricles. And then the thing is, remember I said that the AV node, right, it's kind of like the only conduit that lets signals flow from the SA node, bam, 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 to the ventricles. The thing is, if you create another conduit, right, so like the bundle of, like in Wolf Parkinson White, right, where you have like this bundle of Kent and blood flows and signals flow directly from the atria to the ventricles, you can see how that can cause a problem, right, because that slowdown mechanism of the AV node is no longer there. Right, so the ventricles may not have filled appropriately before the ventricles are depolarized and contract. So you can see that if the ventricles have not filled appropriately, right, you're essentially having like some kind of diastolic dysfunction. It's like almost like a functional diastolic dysfunction. So you do not send, you don't have enough of a cardiac output because not much went into the ventricles in the first place. So you can see why a person may be symptomatic if they have a Wolf Parkinson White syndrome. That's kind of like the pathophysiology behind that. And then some other things I kind of want to talk about, right? So remember that if you're looking at this on a histological basis, right? So we have basically like the inner layer of the heart is lined by endocardium, right? So we have endocardium. And the thing is that endocardium, right, like lines the walls of the atria, lines the walls of the ventricles, lines the walls of the, of the valves of the heart, right? So that's why endocarditis, right? It's an inflammation of the endocardium, right? It usually presents as like valvular problems, right? And then after the endocardium, we actually have something called the myocardium, right? We have the myocardium. After the myocardium, we then have the epicardium, right? The thing is the epicardium, like, has a second name. And a second name for the epicardium is the visceral pericardium, right? Because remember, the heart has a pouch that surrounds it, right? The pericardium, right? But the thing is, we have like the parietal pericardium and the visceral pericardium. The visceral pericardium is the thing that literally encases the heart itself. And another name for the visceral pericardium is the epicardium, right? Now, the parietal pericardium is the thing that's more on the outside, right? And there's like pericardial fluid that's kind of like between that and the visceral pericardium. And again, remember, there's usually just a little amount of fluid, right, between the pericardial layers. And the reason you have that little amount of fluid, right, is because it kind of helps you prevent friction, right, between like the two parts of the, between like the visceral pericardium and the parietal pericardium. We kind of make sense, right? Because you remember the heart is constantly moving, right? Whenever you have two moving parts, you want to try to reduce friction between those things, right? Because if there is friction between those things, right, who knows, maybe you could auscultate a friction rub on exam in a patient that has a pericarditis, right? And I mean, if too much fluid builds up in that pericardial cavity, the person can have like a pericardial effusion, or they can have like cardiac tamponade, right? So again, I know like, yeah, I'm talking about cardiac anatomy, but notice I'm trying to integrate it with multiple other things that you could see tested on an exam. So so I guess let's sort of say a few more things about the anatomy of the heart, right? So remember, right, we have like the wall that separates the right atrium and the left atrium, and then we have the wall that separates the right ventricle and the left ventricle. And I will potentially say some more things about this when I talk about like cardiac embryology. That's a different podcast. That certainly is not something I want to cover here, so I don't give you guys a headache, because that's like another complex bit of information there. So the left side of the heart in general has much higher pressures than the right side, right? So whenever a person has like a hole in the heart, right? So if they have a hole between the right atrium, left atrium, like an ASD, right? Blood will flow from the left atrium to the right atrium, right? If a person has a VSD, blood will flow from the left ventricle to the right ventricle, right? And although over time, if you keep having blood flowing to the right side of the heart, the right side of the heart cannot deal with all those pressures for a long enough period of time. So that chronically increased blood flow to the right side of the heart will ultimately like increase like pulmonary arterial resistance. Person can get pulmonary hypertension. And then at some point, the pressures on the right side of the heart may exceed the pressures on the left side of the heart, right? And then instead of having like a left to right shunt, basically, you then have a right to left shunt, right? That's what's known as Eisenmenger physiology, right? I mean, it's obviously not physiology, it's pathology. It's pathologic, right? Although a right to left shunt is physiologic when you're in utero, but it becomes pathologic when you have that after you're born, right? So that's kind of like a bad thing that can happen there. And remember, ASD, don't forget that with Down syndrome, right? That's the big association you want to remember for your exams. Because again, when I talk about cardiac embryology, I will make some mention of all the stuff known as like the endocardial cushions and all that crap. But those endocardial cushions, they actually derive from neurocrest. And the thing is, in Down syndrome, they tend to have a lot of problems with like neurocrest cell migration. So they may have issues with like the endocardial cushions, so they may have like ASDs. In fact, patients with Down syndrome tend to have more of a primum ASD. A primum ASD is kind of rare, but if you see it, it's usually found in a patient that has a Down syndrome, right? And then if a person has a VSD, it's usually like a membranous VSD. But again, I'll talk about this, all this other stuff, when I talk about cardiac embryology, right? And again, obviously, right, remember that VSDs, right, will present as like this holosystolic murmur at the left sternal border, right? And then an ASD will cause like the wide fixed split of the S2 heart sound. Again, I'm going to talk about the pathophys behind all this stuff, because the thing is, many people think that step one is a memorization exam. It's not. I'll just tell you that right now. It's not. You do need to memorize a lot of stuff. Don't get me wrong. But the thing is, most times when you read questions, you notice that they're not necessarily testing, do you remember this factoid? They're usually testing, do you understand this factoid? Because the thing is, they may not test the direct factoid you've memorized, but they will test it in a context where you're not necessarily regurgitating the factoid, but you are taking the understanding of that factoid you've memorized to apply to that like unfamiliar scenario that closely parallels what you've learned, and then use it to solve the question. So again, just as you're studying for step one, I always tell people the cornerstone of any successful studying, whether you're a resident or an intern or a med student or a college student, doesn't matter. The first thing you need to do is you need to understand first, and then after that, make repeated passes so you commit it to memory. So, I guess since we've sort of talked about the heart, right? So let's talk about the conduits that take blood away from the heart, right? So like the arteries, right? So the thing is, there are many different types of arteries, right? So there's like the muscular arteries, there's the elastic arteries, right? And those two kinds of arteries, you kind of want to understand like some salient differences between those things. The thing is, the muscular arteries, right? Those arteries, right? So, okay, let me just say a few general things about arteries first, right? So, arteries, right? They have like an intima, median, and adventitia, right? The intima is lined by like simple squamous epithelium, and then the media usually contains smooth muscle and elastic fibers, right? And then the adventitia, I kind of think of it as like surrounding connective tissue. Okay, so there's the intima, there's the media, and there's the adventitia. Okay, so again, some people call it tunica intima, tunica media, tunica adventitia. Okay, and again, intima, simple squamous epithelium. Again, that's how you have to know for step one. Media contains smooth muscle with varying amounts of elastic fibers, right? And then the adventitia is kind of like connective tissue. It kind of like has like, it's like a support structure. It contains like nerves. Sometimes it contains vasa vasorum. Sometimes it contains some other like supportive elements. Okay, so now that you have that general understanding, right? So let's sort of talk about the two types of arteries, right? So we have the muscular arteries. The muscular arteries, I sort of think of them as like medium-sized arteries, right? So they're kind of like small arteries. So arteries like your radial artery or your artery that supplies the spleen, right? So like your splenic artery, right? Those are examples of muscular arteries. The thing is, muscular arteries, they contain like the they contain the tunica intima, they contain the tunica media, they contain the tunica adventitia. But the thing is, for the most part, in their tunica adventitia, they generally do not have vasa vasorum. So vasa vasorum are basically like blood vessels that specifically supply the supply the tunica adventitia, right? Because the thing is, if you have a very big artery, right, like the elastic arteries, for example, and I'll talk about that shortly. The elastic arteries are your big bad arteries, like your ureter, right, is an example of an elastic artery. Your branches, like your major branches of the ureter, like your SMA, for example, that supplies like your jejunum, your ileum, your ascending colon, and your proximal two-thirds of your transverse colon, right? Those are large arteries, right? Those are elastic arteries. Those arteries, they are very big. So all parts of the wall of those arteries, right, it doesn't make sense for them to depend on oxygen diffusing from the lumen of the artery and giving them enough for nutrition. That's not very practical. So for those big arteries, they tend to have a crap ton of vasovisorum, okay? The vasovisorum, they are like blood vessels that are literally just for the arteries themselves to help them like sort of get nutrients and get oxygen on board. Now, but smaller arteries, they either don't have vasovisorum or they have very diminished amounts of vasovisora. So those are, again, high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. Now, the thing is, in fact, with this whole vasovisorum business, right? Okay, let me talk about the arteries. Again, sorry, I'm sort of jumping all over the place. I'm, again, largely giving this from memory. So I'm kind of, but again, I have ideas of what I want to talk about. But the thing is, the elastic arteries, right? So the thing that makes them elastic arteries are the fact that they contain a lot of like elastic fibers in their media, right? So remember I said that muscular arteries, elastic arteries, they are kinds of arteries. And I said that arteries, you differentiate them basically by how big they are, that's one, and also by how much elastic fiber, how much they have in the way of elastic fibers in their media, right? So your elastic arteries, they contain a ton of elastic fibers in their media, right, in their tunica media, so like the middle part of the arterial wall. And remember that these elastic fibers come from things like fibrillin, right? So if imagine they give you a question about a person that is like 6 foot tall and then presents with like severe chest pain relating to the back, I really hope under those circumstances you're thinking about Marfan's, right? You're thinking about Marfan syndrome. In Marfan syndrome, right, remember it's a chromosome 15 issue. It's like autosomal dominant inheritance. You have problems with fibrillin. When you have problems with fibrillin, right, you're not going to make great elastic fibers, right? So because those people don't make great elastic fibers, they're very, so like, because the thing is, elasticity, right, means the ability to snap back to your original dimensions after you've been distended. The problem is, if you have issues with your elastic fibers, you will not have the ability to snap back to your original dimensions after you've been distended. You may get distended. And remember, the ureter, right, is a big elastic artery. It constantly pulsates, because it's receiving blood from the left ventricle. The left ventricle operates under very, very high pressures, right? So if a person has Marfan syndrome, they have like weak elastic fibers, and then they're boom, pulsating their ureter, you can kind of imagine that the ureter will not always snap back to its original dimensions with each distension. So over time, those people actually have like distension of the ureter, right? And that's why aortic regurgitation is fairly common in Marfans, right? And the reason it's common in Marfans is, again, because they have like massive dilation of their aortic root, right? So if they have dilation of the aortic root, of course they are going to have like aortic regurgitation, right? Because you are basically pulling the aortic cusps apart, right? So again, that's a high yield thing to understand. And remember that, again, patients with Marfans, again, this kind of explains why they are at high risk for aortic dissection, because again, the media is not as strong as it should be. And please, I'll just go ahead and say this. I'm going to repeat this so many times. I've probably repeated it many, many times in many different podcasts that I have given. But don't forget that the Buzz phrase pathophysiology you want to remember for aortic dissection on MBMEs is something called cystic medial necrosis or cystic medial degeneration. The Buzz phrase pathophysiology you want to remember for mitral valve prolapse, okay, for mitral valve prolapse is myxomatous degeneration, right? And then the Buzz phrase pathophysiology you want to remember for aortic stenosis is calcification of the valve, okay? It's calcification of the valve that causes those problems, right? And then the another classic series of MBME questions, right, is that what's like the biggest risk factor for mitral stenosis? The biggest risk factor is rheumatic fever, right? And then they can ask you, what is the biggest risk factor for AFib? The biggest risk factor for AFib is mitral stenosis, right? And then they can ask you, what is the biggest risk factor for a myocardial infarction? The biggest risk factor for an MI is, guess what? Smoking. Smoking is the biggest risk factor for myocardial infarctions and for triple H, right? So abdominal aortic aneurysms. And again, I'll get to that in a bit. And then the biggest risk factor for strokes and aortic dissection is hypertension. Okay. Again, I promise you all these words I just said, I'll be shocked if you don't see at least one or two of these things tested on any USMLE exam you take in some way, shape or form. Okay. So again, I've sort of talked about the elastic arteries and how they have a ton of elastic fibers in their media, right? Your muscular arteries, they really do not have much in the way of elastic fibers in their media, right? And remember, right, kind of like the way things flow, right? So you have blood flow from your arteries, and then they go to your arterioles, and then they go to your capillaries, and then they go to your venules, and then those go to veins, and then those veins return blood back to the heart, right? So the thing is, you kind of want to remember is some specific properties of these vessels, right? So your arterioles, they are resistance vessels. They are the biggest point of resistance in your arterial system, right? So, I mean, your blood vessel system. So it kind of makes sense that those things have a ton of smooth muscle. In fact, in general, you tend to find more smooth muscle in your arterioles compared to your venules, for example. In general, arteries just have more smooth muscle than veins. Veins do have smooth muscle though, but very limited, right? So it should make sense that you should find a lot of like alpha 1 receptors on your arteries, because again, if you activate those alpha 1 receptors with drugs like phenylephrine or ephedrine, right, those will clamp down on those vessels, right? Those will increase resistance, that will increase systemic vascular resistance. And remember that whenever systemic vascular resistance increases, your diastolic blood pressure goes up, right? So if your SVR is going up and that's the only thing that's being varied, right, that means your pulse pressure should get smaller, right? And again, if your systemic vascular resistance is increasing, your afterload is going up. And if your afterload is going up, your heart won't be able to send enough blood out, right? So that means your cardiac output is going down. Again, all these like physiologic parameters, I'll talk about those in a different podcast, okay? But again, I'm just trying to give you a preview of coming attractions, if you may. And then your venules the venules that come right after your capillaries, right? So they're called like post-capillary venules. They're kind of high yield to know for certain reasons, right? So the first thing is, those venules actually do not have much in the way of much in the way of smooth muscle, if any, right? Most post-capillary venules actually don't have smooth muscle like at all, right? It's literally like most of them just have like an epithelial layer, and then you have like some pericytes. Some pericytes, they're kind of like cells that constitute like something called like a basal lamina. They sort of surround those like that single layer of epithelial cells. So those things are very susceptible to high pressures, right? And you may say, Divine, so why are these postcapillary venules so thin? They are so thin because you kind of need things to be able to go through those walls, right? So like your immune system cells, right? So like what is it called? When you have like an acute inflammatory response, right? Where you have like your neutrophils, extravasatin, and all that stuff with all those proteins like MAC1, LFA1, and all that crap. How do you think they're able to go through those walls? They're able to go through those post-capillary venule walls because those walls are thin, okay? Again, that's actually something that's high yield to know, right? Most times, your immune system cells extravasate into the interstitium surrounding your blood vessels by doing what? By going across the walls of post-capillary venules. In fact, when I get to the immunology podcast, the comprehensive immunology reviews that I'll make in the future, hopefully, you'll learn about how you can target like antigens and like your dendritic cells and whatnot to lymph nodes and stuff like that. And you target those things through these things called HEVs, like your high endothelial venules. It so happens that those high endothelial venules are actually a specialized type of post-capillary venule, right? So again, that's kind of like a nice immunology integration there. Another interesting integration, I'm not saying this because they're interesting. I mean, obviously they're interesting. I mean, you can tell from the way I'm talking about this, basically, I'll just tell you this. I love tutoring. I love teaching. Teaching is the best. It's the most amazing job in the world. I don't know why we don't have more teachers, but that's a different story for another day. But so that's, again, kind of like a high yield thing to know. And then another reason you want to remember these post-capillary venules is that They tend to be dilated by ACE inhibitors, right? So the thing is, remember I said that capillaries, right? Remember, arterioles feed capillaries, and then from capillaries, so a capillary is fed by an arteriole, and a capillary is drained by a venule, right? So a capillary is drained by an arteriole, a capillary is fed by an arteriole, a capillary is drained by a venule, right? The thing is, your calcium channel blockers, to be more specific, your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like verapamil and, no, not verapamil, diltiazem, like amlodipine, felodipine, like micardipine and whatnot, their primary mechanism of action is that they dilate precapillary arterioles, okay? They dilate precapillary arterioles. So think about it. If you dilate precapillary arterioles, right, you can already begin to imagine that you'll be sending more blood to the capillaries themselves, right? Right, because again, they are pre-capillary, they are before the capillary arterioles. So you send more blood to the capillaries. And the thing is, when you send more blood to those capillaries, right, the hydrostatic pressures in those capillaries begin to increase, right? Remember those, remember your whole business with these are Starling forces, right? So there's like four Starling forces you always want to think about in capillaries. So there's the hydrostatic pressures that exist within the capillaries themselves, right? If those hydrostatic pressures in those capillaries increase, that will send more blood across the capillary wall, right? That will promote extravasation of fluid. And then there's hydrostatic pressures that you find in the interstitium that surrounds the capillary wall, right? If you have increased hydrostatic pressures in those in the interstitium, that tends to push more blood into the capillaries, right? So that disfavors extravasation of fluid, right? And then the other two pressures, right? So you can have oncotic pressures inside the capillaries, right? So oncotic pressures inside the capillaries. Those oncotic pressures, I sort of think of them as like osmotic pressures. And like every osmotic pressure draws water towards itself, right? So whenever you have high oncotic pressures inside capillary beds, that does not favor or disfavors extravasation of fluid, right? And if you kind of think about that, right? So for example, if a person has a nephrotic syndrome where they're peeing out protein in their urine, right? They become hypoalbuminemic because albumin constitutes the primary protein that you find within your bloodstream. It's the primary contributor to your oncotic pressure. So if a person has like nephrotic syndrome where they're peeing out protein in their urine, or they have liver disease where they're not making albumin in the first place, or they have Ménétrier's disease, on occasional NBMEs, they call Ménétrier's disease a protein losing gastropathy, where they're literally like getting rid of protein through their GI tracts, those people become hypoalbuminemic, right? Or if a person even he has like kwashiorkor, where they have a deficiency of protein, right? If you're not taking protein, you're not going to be making albumin, right? So whenever you have low oncotic pressures because you're hypoalbuminemic, right? Your oncotic pressures go down. If your oncotic pressures go down, right, you're not going to be able to retain enough fluid inside capillaries. If you do not retain enough fluid inside capillaries, that will favor extravasation of fluid, right? So that's why people that have nephrotic syndrome or liver disease or Ménétrier's disease or kwashiorkor, they tend to have like edema, right, of their extremities, right? And even people that have kwashiorkor, right, and you see those kids that have like big bellies, that big belly is actually from edema. It's actually not from like, is like many people say like, oh, why do they have those big bellies that you see in the classic images? The reason they have those big bellies, literally, it's from edema because they are hypoalbuminemic, right? So they have low oncotic pressures. Now, and then the fourth Starling force, right, is like the oncotic pressure that exists in the interstitium that surrounds, again, the capillary walls. If you have high oncotic pressures in the interstitium that surrounds the capillary walls, again, that will draw water towards itself. That will favor extravasation of fluid, okay? So again, kind of to summarize, the things that favor extravasation of fluid are high hydrostatic pressures inside the capillary, or high oncotic pressures in the interstitium that surrounds the capillary, right? So if, for example, a person has ARDS, right, and they have immune cells and all that stuff kind of like leaking to the interstitium of their lungs, that attracts fluid, right? And that causes like pulmonary edema. If a person has inflammation, right? So remember like tumor, rubra, and dolor, right? So the the tumor, right, is like the swelling, right? The reason people get swelling when you have inflammation is, again, there's an increase in vascular permeability from things like histamine and bradykinin. So your immune system cells and like cell like soup that runs in your blood vessel sort of leaks into the interstitium, and that sort of attracts fluid with it, right? And again, that causes a lot of trouble, right? That causes edema because you're attracting fluid. So kind of back to my original story where I was talking about like my dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. So the dilate precapillary arterioles, right? So those things, if they dilate those precapillary arterioles, you get more blood flow into your capillaries, right? So the hydrostatic pressures in your capillaries go up, and that promotes the extravasation of fluid from your capillaries. And when you have extravasation of fluid from your capillaries, you get peripheral edema. That is the mechanism behind the peripheral edema that is associated with taking a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. So it should make sense then that if you want to treat that peripheral edema associated with taking a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, you'd want to potentially dilate the postcapillary venules, right? The postcapillary venules, right? Because when you dilate those postcapillary venules, guess what happens? You decrease the hydrostatic pressures within those capillaries. And when you decrease those hydrostatic pressures within the capillaries, disfavors or does not encourage extravasation of fluid. So it so happens that your ACE inhibitors are very good dilators of your postcapillary venules. Okay, so ACE inhibitors are the drugs of choice in the treatment of the peripheral edema that is associated with taking a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. Now, the thing is, you may see why does that make sense. Remember, ACE inhibitor decreases the synthesis of angiotensin 2. Angiotensin 2 is one of the most powerful vasoconstrictors in the body. So if you're making less angiotensin 2, you're making less of a powerful vasoconstrictor. So you have net vasodilation, right? And I just said that, so again, that's a high yield tidbit to know there. So notice I'm talking about like anatomy as it relates to the cardiovascular system. But you see that I'm not just giving you straight facts. Again, because again, if the USMLE was an exam of straight facts, everyone would get a 270. Obviously, that doesn't happen, right? The reason that doesn't happen is situations like this, where again, they want you to be able to integrate concepts amongst multiple disciplines, right? So another high yield thing to kind of be aware of here, right? So I just said earlier, before I went on this rant, that capillaries are fed by arterioles, and then capillaries are drained by venules. That is not always true, right? The thing is, you can have certain situations in the body where a capillary is fed by an arteriole and a capillary is drained by an arteriole. Okay, that is something known as an arterial portal system. Okay, arterial portal system. You generally create portal systems when you need to have some complex regulation going on, right? So take, for example, the kidneys, right? So remember that your glomerular capillaries, right? Your glomerulus literally is a capillary system. It is fed by the afferent arteriole. It is drained by the efferent arteriole. That is an example of an arterial portal system. If you're looking for another situation where you have like a capillary that instead of being fed by an arteriole, it's fed by a venule and drained by a venule, think about like the portal system that operates in the liver, right? So remember that you have sinusoidal capillaries that operate in your liver. Those sinusoidal capillaries are fed by portal veins, and those sinusoidal capillaries are drained by the hepatic vein, right? So that's an example of a venous portal system. Another place where you have a venous portal system is like in the hypothalamus. Okay, so like they call it like the hypophyseal portal system. So again, these are again all kind of like high yield integrations you want to keep in mind for exams, right? And then I've been making this big fuss about the vasovisorum, right? So I say that the vasovisorum is important because again, it kind of supplies blood to elements of the arterial wall, especially like big arteries, like your elastic arteries, that are not necessarily able to get oxygen and nutrients by straight diffusion from the lumen of the artery, right? So why is that important? The thing is, if a person has atherosclerosis, right, in the walls of like an artery, right, by having atherosclerosis, think about it, you're essentially increasing the diffusion distance that oxygen and nutrients have to go through to get to other layers of the arterial wall that are kind of like distal to the lumen, right? So if you have atherosclerosis, you get really thankful that you have a vasovisorum, right? So the thing is, think about this. The aorta, right? So we have like the aorta, we have the ascending aorta, aortic arch, descending aorta, and then we have the aorta that is above the renal arteries, and then we have the aorta that is below the renal arteries. So here's the thing that happens. The thing is, once you get beneath the renal artery, like the aorta beneath the renal artery actually does not have, like the walls of the aorta beneath the renal artery lacks a vasa visura. So think about it. If a person, right, has atherosclerosis of their infrarenal aorta, right, you can already begin to see that nutrients and oxygen will have a very hard time diffusing across that wall. And if the nutrients and oxygen have a hard time diffusing across that wall, the more peripheral parts of the wall of the infrarenal aorta gets like super weak, dies, right, and then begins to distend, right? So that's why triple A's are very common, right? That's why abdominal aortic aneurysms are very, 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 very common, right? If you want to take this to an even more logical conclusion, right? So if you kind of look at syphilis, right? So why does syphilis cause an aortitis? What's the aortitis that happens with syphilis? The truth is, the aortitis that happens with syphilis actually happens because syphilis, so like T. pallidum, remember it's a spirochete, actually causes like an inflammation and destruction of the vasa visorum of the vasa visorum that you find around the aortic arch and the ascending aorta. Right. So again, by destroying those vasa visora, you're beginning to create ischemia in those more peripheral walls of the ascending aorta and the aortic arch. So again, that can cause dilation. That's why aortic regurge and like aortic dissection are things that can happen to people that have syphilis. Right. That really is the pathophysiology behind the aortitis that accompanies syphilis. And I know this has kind of gone on for long, so I'm going to round up soon. But again, don't forget these high yield things with your arteries. Again, I promise you, this is one of those things where if you just understand, it just makes it a lot easier for you to approach exam questions, right? So I've been saying a lot of things about arteries, right? So let me just say a few quick things about veins, right? So veins, right, again, they send blood back to the heart, right? Your pulmonary veins send blood back to the left atrium. Your systemic veins, like your SVC, IVC, send blood back to the right atrium, right? And the thing is, again, your veins, kind of like your arteries, they have like the tunica intima, they have the tunica media, they have the tunica adventitia. And your large veins, again, kind of like your SVC, IVC, for example, in their tunica adventitia, they tend to have a lot of, vasa visura. Okay, so this whole construct of vasa visura is very, very, very important. Okay, very, very, very important. And again, the walls of your veins, right, like the media, has smooth muscle, but doesn't have as much smooth muscle as your arteries, right? So if you have smooth muscle, right, it should make sense that you should be responsive to alpha-1 stimulation that causes vasoconstriction, or beta-2 stimulation, which causes a vasodilation, right? So your arteries and your veins both respond to those two types of receptors. Now, the thing is with your veins, right? So because your veins don't have as much smooth muscle, right? They are not super contractile, right? So that's why most of your veins tend to have like valves that essentially like prevent like backflow of blood, so that blood flows in just one direction, right? Your arteries don't necessarily need valves to prevent backflow, right? So if you kind of think about it, if a person has veins and the valves in their veins don't work so well, right, that's where they can begin to get into trouble with like varicose veins, right? Because they begin to have like pooling of blood in their veins, because your veins actually, this is actually how you ought to know, your veins are capacitance vessels. So because they are capacitance vessels, they can actually pull blood for pretty long periods of time, right? So they have like a very high capacity for blood, right? Versus your arterioles that are more your resistance vessels, right? So your veins, if a person has varicose veins, their blood just basically, their veins essentially just have like more They get more compliant because they don't, I guess, let me, maybe I shouldn't use that term because that's not very accurate, but they pull more blood in their veins, so they have like lower extremity edema. Remember, those people classically on NBMEs, they tend to have ulcers above the medial malleolus, right? That's something kind of high yield you want to keep in mind for exams. And then, so if your veins don't have enough smooth muscle in their walls, right, it kind of makes sense that the skeletal muscle that kind of surrounds your veins can play a pretty big role in how much blood is stored in a vein or how much blood goes away from a vein, right? So if you kind of think of it this way, right? So if, for example, a person is like hypotensive, classically in the ICU, they will just like raise the person's legs up, because by raising the person's legs up, guess what happens, right? You are essentially contracting their veins with like the skeletal muscle that sort of surrounds them, right? And when you hit those veins hard, that blood flows back to the heart. So you're basically getting more venous return, because by getting more of that venous return, you get more of a cardiac output. And the thing is, if, for example, right, so again, just kind of going with this whole skeletal muscle aiding in contraction of veins construct, if, for example, you go on a long trip, right, let's say you go on a long trip and you don't wiggle your legs, or you're in a long flight or whatever, guess what happens, right? Blood begins to pool in your veins, and when you have stasis of blood, can you remember the SHE mnemonic for venous thromboembolism? So like stasis, hypercoagulability, and endothelial damage, right? So you have stasis of blood. When you have stasis of blood, guess what happens? That increases your risk of forming clot, right? That increases your risk of forming a DVT. Okay, so again, those are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind, right, for exams. And the thing is, this is probably a little low yield, but I remember learning this back in the day when I was studying for step one. There are things like your deep veins, and there are things like your superficial veins. The thing is, your deep veins tend to operate under higher pressures. Your superficial veins tend to operate under lower pressures, right? So whenever you have an occlusion of a deep vein, right, that essentially shuns blood to your superficial veins, okay? That shuns blood to your superficial veins. And if you shun blood to your superficial veins, right, they are superficial. So literally you can see them. That's why you can see like leg swelling and all that stuff when a person has a DVT. Right. And again, don't forget that if you have a thrombus of your deep vein, that is the thing that can cause a PE. When you have a thrombus of your superficial vein, those things rarely, if ever, cause PEs. And then the final thing I will say is, there's one thing I want to talk about. It's kind of skipped my mind. Come on, Divine, what did you want to talk about? If they give you an NBME question, because this shows up quite commonly, and since I'm talking about things, I might as well talk about it. If they give you a question, actually two things, I apologize, two things. So if they give you an NBME question about a patient that has like pain, like severe leg pain or like arm pain, and then they tell you that they have a palpable cord, like a linear, thick palpable cord on one of their extremities. And then they say, what's the next step in management? They'll try to trick you into giving those people like anticoagulation. Don't do that. Those people have actually have thrombosis of a vein, but the vein that they've thrombosed is a superficial vein. And again, superficial venous thromboses do not cause PEs. Okay, it's deep venous thrombosis that cause PEs, right? So if a person thromboses a superficial vein and then they have like inflammation around it, that's something called superficial thrombophlebitis. It's one of those relatively common causes of post-op fever where you're like, this person, I've given antibiotics, not working. I've ruled out atelectasis, I've ruled out wound infection, I've ruled out this, ruled out that, and they don't seem to be getting better. Think about superficial thrombophlebitis under those circumstances, okay? So those people, just give them NSAIDs, treat the inflammation, that's all they need. They do not need anticoagulation, they do not need heparin, right, versus a DVT that is treated with heparin. Okay, and then the last thing I want to say, and then I promise I'll round up. Many of these lectures, I have like a list of topics I'm going to talk about, but as I talk about things, other things begin to pop in my mind that relate, and then I just try to integrate them in. So another thing that popped up in my mind is this concept of an AV fistula, right? So remember, I just said that you have like arteries, arterioles, capillaries, then venules, then veins, right? The thing is, right, capillaries are where like exchange of oxygen and nutrients and all that crap happens. So the thing is, your capillaries kind of like slow down blood a little. I almost think of capillaries as like the AV node of your circulatory system. So the thing is, when you create an AV fistula, guess what you're taking out of circulation? You're taking those, you're taking that kind of like slow down mechanism that exists between arterioles and venules, right? So if you have an AV fistula, you take that out. And when you take that out and blood is flowing directly from like an artery to a vein, that's what's called an AV fistula. The problem is, if you take out that slow down capillary mechanism, then your heart becomes more overworked, right? Because your heart, like, I sort of think of it as like a freight train that never stops. Blood just keeps flowing at high speed, artery to vein, artery to vein, artery to vein, artery to vein. Nothing is slowing down within your capillaries. When that happens, that's a problem, right? Because your heart, I sort of think of it as your heart sort of depends on blood slowing down in capillaries to sort of take a breather and then recover before it starts pumping again. If you, obviously that's not what happens, but I'm just giving you like a nice way to understand it. So if you take those capillaries out of the equation, if you have an AV fistula, that can ultimately cause something called a high output heart failure. Okay, that's can ultimately cause a high output heart failure. And I mean, an AV fistula is good for certain reasons, right? Like if a person wants to go on dialysis, right, you create an AV fistula so you have like more efficient filtration of their blood. But guess what? One of the, in fact, the most common cause of death in patients that have that are on dialysis is actually, it's not one of the most common, it's the most common cause of death in patients that are on dialysis is cardiovascular disease. And this potentially explains part of why that may be the case, right? Because again, by creating an AV fistula, you're essentially putting those people in a situation where they have high output of heart failure. Now, on the whole context of high output heart failure, right, there are many things that cause high output heart failure on NBMEs. One is an AV fistula, right? If a person has an AV malformation, again, where they have like a direct connection between like arteries and veins, right? So if a person has like an AV malformation in the brain or in the lungs or in whatever, right? Again, that can also cause a high output heart failure. Or if a person has like bones that are hypervascular, like in Paget's disease, that can again also cause high output heart failure. Because the thing is, again, when you don't have those capillaries, you essentially have a functional decrease in systemic vascular resistance. So the heart has to always work super, super, super hard. That's the thing that causes the high output heart failure. And then the last thing that can cause high output heart failure is if a person has like severe anemia. Because think about it, right? If you think about the oxygen delivery equation, I mean the oxygen content equation, and again, I'll talk about these, this podcast, I'm just focused on anatomy. I'll talk about cardiac physiology in other podcasts. But basically, if a person has low hemoglobin, the oxygen content of their blood goes down, right? So your body's like, you know what? I kind of need this oxygen real bad. Right? So the way your heart compensates is by increasing cardiac output to compensate for that decreased oxygen supply to organs so that you basically have like more go arounds of blood through your tissues so that they can get enough oxygen. Right? So since the heart is needing to supply greater than normal amounts of blood, that again can cause high output heart failure. So the classic NBME question will be a person that has like a hemoglobin of like 3 or 4, and then they tell you that their ejection fraction measured by echocardiography is 70%. Those people have high output of heart failure. So, again, I promise you this podcast is basically all these cardiology podcasts I'm gonna make, they're like floridly high yield for the USMLE step one. You kind of want to understand all these things I've talked about. And again, as I round up, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS, and Step 3 exams. And also like the preclinical med school exams and the third year clerkship shelf exams. And then if you have a college buddy that's like pre-med, basically, I essentially tutor every pre-med subject. So like physics, general chemistry, organic chemistry, physiology, histology, biochemistry, all that stuff. And then if you're a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, or a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, I do offer one-on-one advice and consulting for that. I mean, I've been on the admissions committee of a top two med school for a year. So I've sifted through thousands of high quality applications. And I mean, this past like era cycle, I worked with hundreds of people, and pretty much everyone I worked with matched, and almost like 90-ish percent actually matched into their first choice. So take that for what you will, but I have a very good track record with these things. So I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and I will see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.